Welcome to the LSE Events Podcast by the London School of Economics and Political Science. Get ready to hear from some of the most influential international figures in the social sciences.
Okay, welcome everybody to the LSE. Thank you all for coming. It's a hot evening in London. Wimbledon's on, so we know you've got lots of other temptations. But we're here tonight to talk about a really important new book, which Ben Chu, sitting to my right, has just published. My name is Richard Davis. I teach economics here at the LSE. I also run something called the Economics Observatory. I can see brilliantly that some of you have got our book mark in your hands. If you scan the QR code, you can find your way to our newsletter, which is a really good way of keeping up with all that we do. You can ask us a question on economics, and we will try and answer it on the Economics Observatory page. So please do that. But my main role this evening is to ask a few questions and get the conversation going with Ben Chu. Ben is a journalist with rich experience. He currently works at BBC Verify, which plays a vital role in this world of fast-moving news and disinformation in fact-checking and getting to the bottom of the real truth of stories. Previously, he's been economics editor at some fantastic places, including the Newsnight TV show, the Independent newspaper. This is Ben's second book. His first book was about China, called Chinese Whispers. I think that was also maybe a bit of a prelude to the Verify job, because the subtitle was Why Everything We've Heard Is Wrong. Getting to the truth. And now he's back with a book all about trade, which couldn't be more perfectly timed. So I'd like to welcome Ben to the LSE. So here we have it, Exile Economics. And I wondered, Ben, if we could start, as you do, in Sri Lanka with a really interesting story you tell about how, it's about unintended consequences, I guess, how the banning of a particular type of fertilizer could lead to really damaging effects to people that you interviewed.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for that introduction. And great to see so many of you here. It's very touching, as you said, that on a hot day like this, you've come to an event like this. So thank you so much. Yes, so Exile Economics. I suppose the one of the reasons I wanted to write it is precisely because of what I saw, Richard, in Sri Lanka. When I was sent there by Newsnight, it was in 2022. It was January 2023, actually. Sri Lanka had defaulted on its debts, and it was in a massive economic crisis, real trouble. And Newsnight was covering the global economic cost of living crisis, and it felt like Sri Lanka was the ground zero of that crisis. So they put me on a plane, as they do, is go and tell the story from there. And I was fascinated to discover on landing that it was the legacy, they were dealing with the legacy of a really catastrophic decision that affected Sri Lankan agriculture that was taken in April of 2021, so a couple of years earlier. Effectively, the government of Sri Lanka had unilaterally banned the import of fertilizers, which were vital for Sri Lankan agriculture, for its tea production and other things it produced. And the lack of these fertilizers had resulted in a huge drop in the productivity of its agriculture. And the people who worked in the tea plantations and other parts of Sri Lankan farming were dealing with the consequences. So we went to a tea plantation in the central part of Sri Lanka called Nuwara Eliya, and interviewed some of the people who worked on that plantation. And they told us really quite harrowing stories about how they were going hungry. There were actually 6 million people in Sri Lanka at that time who were food insecure. People were really, really desperate. It was having a disastrous effect on their lives. So, of course, Newsnight, we told that story, but we wanted to put it in the bigger context and sort of say, well, why was this decision taken? And the decision was justified by the Sri Lankan government at the time on grounds which I would now describe as exile economics lines. And what do I mean by that? I'm talking about a decision to cut off trade links with other countries on the promise that will make you not weaker, but stronger. So the Sri Lankan government, the president said that we don't need these chemical fertilizers from other countries because they are having adverse ecological impacts in Sri Lanka. And actually, we should be more self-reliant in terms of in our farming practices. It was a complete, as I've described, it was a complete disaster. It lasted 6 months, but the damage was done because the harvest was effectively ruined for that year in terms of what it would normally produce. And what that showed me is that sometimes the political rhetoric is entirely at odds with the economic and social reality when it comes to when it comes to trade and when it comes to the people talking about self-reliance. I mean, this was something which did not make Sri Lanka more ecologically friendly. It's something that did not make Sri Lanka more secure. It's had something that had the exact opposite of the impact which the Sri Lankan government was saying for it. So I thought, and I start the book, as Richard describes, with this vignette, with this story, because I think it's symptomatic and symbolic of something that you can find right across the world in lots of different areas. Politicians, political entrepreneurs, you'll know their names, you'll know who they are, you'll recognise them, saying we should, there's a simple way to become more prosperous, to be more secure, and that is to put up barriers between ourselves and other countries, whether it's in importing goods, importing services, in terms of the movement of people across borders. There's a very strong argument that's being made in many, many different countries that interdependence is actually a source of weakness between countries, that multilateral collaboration between nations is a trap, it's something that we want to avoid. And there's an argument, a third strand of exile economics, which is that being more nationally self-sufficient is a good thing that we should be striving for. We should produce what we consume. So I used that vignette, that story about Sri Lanka, to as a kickoff, a starting point to get into those bigger ideas.
And a central point, I took it from the book, is that these ideas are actually kind of quite attractive and tempting and often seem common sense, because if you say to people, well, listen, and you go into some of the interesting history, you know, why wouldn't you be able to want to grow your own food in your own garden? Or similarly, another one you talk about, which maybe you could explain a bit more, is the so-called infant industries argument, which is you're a kind of a new player in the game, you're a new player on the playing field, shouldn't you be kind of protected by the referee in some sense? And those things kind of they're pretty attractive ideas.
They are. Let me just do an experiment. Let me ask you as the audience to put your hands up if you have been attracted in the last, say, 5 years by some of these arguments that actually trade links between countries should be lower, perhaps globalization has gone a bit too far in some areas. If you've been attracted by that idea, maybe you could put your hand up. Let me see. Yeah, interesting. This is the London School of Economics crowd, and we've got people who are putting their hands up to that question, which I think is really, really important, because let me make something clear. When I started writing this book, I wasn't starting it out with all the answers. I wasn't starting out saying it's definitely the case that all these ideas that we should be more self-sufficient in food, in steel production, in medicines, in all these areas, that it's axiomatically true that we should not aim for those things. I wanted to kick the tires, as I said, of those ideas and find out what the truth was. I think as I researched it more and more, I came increasingly to the view that, okay, you can do these things, but there is a very, very big cost to them. And it's nowhere near as simple as a lot of people are making out in all of those different areas. But we asked about food. So let's just drill down into something there, because that is, in a sense, the most beguiling one, isn't it? Because how can we be reliant on other countries for our food? Surely that is more important than iPhones or laptops or whatever you have it. That's something that we should produce at home. The trouble with that argument is that it's a recipe for not feeding the world. If everyone tries to buy local, then people aren't going to get fed. There's an amazing study I cite in the book from 2020, and they said, what if everyone bought local when it comes to food? And they defined that by having someone with a 100-kilometre circle drawn around them, so they could only, extending out in every direction, so they could only source food within 100 kilometres around them. It's one definition of buy local. So if you did that for everyone on the planet, everyone on the planet had these circles around them, what proportion of the planet do people think could actually feed themselves with staple goods, you know, wheat, rice, corn, within that 100-kilometre circle? Has anyone got an idea? What proportion? Almost exactly right, 25%. So only a quarter of the planet, by that definition, could eat and eat locally. That circle around everyone on the planet, for everyone to be able to source their food within that circle, would have to be 2,000 kilometres in radius. So what, given where people live and the size of nations, you're going to have trade for people to get the staple foods that they need to survive. And by the way, this is just staples. This doesn't include luxuries or even things like meat and the complexities of the fodder and the feed for animals trade, which I talk about in the book. So I think just a simple sense check on the idea that it's axiomatically true that people should eat what their own country produces. It's really problematic for a lot of the planet. So that's food. Let's talk about the more complex things like infant industry.
I definitely want to come to those, but let's carry on with the being like as absolutely pro-trade as we can, because I want to push you on some maybe some limits to this argument, but also I want to come to where you think that the costs are. I can see there are a couple of my students in the audience, so forgive me them because they'll have heard this story before, but it is Wimbledon, and I think I'm right in saying, I'm almost sure, that on the Wimbledon trophy, I think the men's trophy, there are pineapples on the top. Now, the reason there are pineapples on the top is precisely, it's more grist for your argument, because when people were first able to bring pineapples back to the UK, it was seen as the most, there's a quote, something like, 'tis the most wondrous food ever invented, or something. It was unbelievable. If you'd never seen a pineapple before and then you tasted it, it blew your mind. And so that's why when if you look around, hopefully now I've told you this, on top of buildings you'll spot pineapples. Yeah. They became a symbol of wealth, of trade, of welcome, and of the benefits of trade, of the wealth-enhancing benefits of trade. But you, while we talk, I want to talk about meat in a sec, but a key, let's quickly get the audience to the core of your argument. Because actually, as I take it, it's partly about advanced nations and that we're going to find these arguments tempting. But actually, the real costs, if exile economics becomes a thing, is actually for the lower income and further down the development chain countries. Is that right?
Yeah, that's how I end the book, when I talk about my own family in China. So I first visited them in 1985. They lived they still live in Guangzhou, and it was astonishing because we were visiting them from Hong Kong. So we were going from this ultra advanced first world country to China, southern Chinese megacity in 1985, and it was, you know, the streets were full of bicycles. They literally couldn't buy things like ice boxes and washing machines, and they had to try and get us to buy them for them and try and get them into the country. It was astonishingly levels of privation, even in 1985. And as I've gone back over many years, I've seen how globalization has completely transformed their lives for the better. China opened up, and it's just incredible to see what they can buy now, the quality of their lives. And to your point, Richard, that I think you can apply that to every developing country has pretty much benefited from globalization over the past decade. And the countries which would stand to benefit the most are those which are most have most integration to come. So if we move into an exile economics world where it's harder for them to integrate, perhaps because America has put huge tariffs on them, making it harder for them to sell their basic staples into the American market, they will suffer the most. Just another point about food, which I think was really striking when I was looking at the statistics. If you take one low-income country, which is Zambia in Africa. Now, on paper, they're very secure when it comes to food because they produce pretty much all they consume. They've got self-sufficiency rates in terms of foods which are in the high 70s, 80s. And yet food insecurity in Zambia is one of the highest levels rates in the world. If you go into the Indian Ocean, you find Mauritius, a couple of thousand miles away in the Indian Ocean. They have very low rates of food self-sufficiency. And yet they have food insecurity levels, which are also incredibly low. So what's going on there? What's the difference between Zambia and Mauritius? It's the fact that Mauritius has become a rich country by integrating into the global economy. It's diversified its economy away from agriculture, and that is what has enabled its people to eat well and to be food secure. Fundamental point I make in the book is that self-sufficiency in food and in other areas, national self-sufficiency does not necessarily equal security, despite what a lot of people will argue.
That's fascinating, and even security is becoming a much more salient point, isn't it? Just in the past year, you know, part of the Chancellor, it's not really on this, but, you know, one of her terms is securonomics, look at defence spending and so on. So this idea that we're living in a newly kind of embattled world where it would be better if we could rely on ourselves is potentially got even more tempting an idea since you started this work. I wanted to ask you a little bit before getting on to maybe some of the limits to globalisation, and then I want to open up to the audience, actually about politics. You talk in a really interesting way about the kind of deep-seated roots of protectionism, actually in the Conservative Party, and the kind of demise of some of the Liberal parties, the old Liberal Party, pre-Liberal Democrats, arguments. Has a kind of strand of thought, a strand of argument that would have started with David Ricardo, I guess, been lost in the UK?
Well, I think what's happening in the UK and actually in many other countries is that old ways of thinking have been coming back. One of the most fascinating things about writing this book was the deep dive I did into the intellectual history of this idea of self-sufficiency, of autarky. And it really starts as a kind of moral argument amongst the ancient Greeks, actually. People like Diogenes, this cynic philosopher who was dressed in rags, barked at strangers in the marketplace to show that he was completely unchained by social conventions. And that was his way of saying, I am morally self-sufficient. That's the only way he could, in his view, anyone could become truly philosophically advanced or wise, was by becoming self-sufficient as much as possible. So he had that idea, and it was very influential in ancient Greece. People like Aristotle took it on and applied it to the Athenian city-state, saying the way for Athens to become powerful and secure is to be self-sufficient. And then you see it going adapted by early Christian thinkers like St. Thomas Aquinas, who said that, well, God is self-sufficient. He's not dependent on anyone else. Therefore, there's something holy about self-sufficiency. And he said, well, that's something that worldly states and nations should take on board. Be more like God. Be more self-sufficient. Be more holy. And you find it... It's this idea that keeps coming back over the centuries. Jean-Jacques Rousseau, we're going to the Enlightenment now and the Romantic period. And he was also a big advocate of self-sufficiency for other reasons, because he thought man in a state of nature, i.e. before he was corrupted by modern society, wandered around the forest in a self-sufficient way. So all these justifications are used to say we should be more self-sufficient. And I was fascinated to just sort of see how this keeps coming back. And to your point, I think what we're living through now is this resurgence of an old idea. In a way, look, mankind has always traded. We've got pretty strong evidence for that going back to Neolithic times. But mankind also, if you look at the intellectual discourse that we've had, there's always been a tendency to say, let's close ourselves off from other people in terms of trade and exchange of ideas. Let's be more enclosed. So I think, you know, what's happening in British politics and American politics and lots of other, in China, in India, you see a lot of these arguments. It's a kind of reversion, actually, that's to an older way of thinking rather than a new departure.
That's really interesting. There must be... Jumping from older ways of thinking to the ultra-modern, there must be... Now, I had come across this company, but your description of it is one of the best I've read, and there must be at least one person in the room that hasn't heard of TSMC and maybe ASML, which I think I'd read about but wouldn't remember the name of. What are these acronym companies, right, and why are they basically running the world?
Well, I think they're two of the most important companies in the world who you possibly might have never heard of. So they are fundamental parts of the global semiconductor supply chain. So every iPhone in your pocket, every laptop you have, certainly every data center in the world.
All of this stuff.
Yeah, all of the tech will have chips in it. And if it's advanced, it will probably have a chip which was designed and made with ASML and TSMC equipment. It's absolute cutting edge, the bleeding edge of technological sophistication. And it's relevant to my book because they are two extremely vulnerable potential nodes in the global economy as well, because there's literally no other company which can do what either of those two can do.
So should we spell them out? So TSMC is Taiwan
Semiconductor Manufacturing Company.
And ASML, can we think of that as Philips?
Yeah, it's an offshoot of Philips, but it's obviously the light bulb manufacturer from the Netherlands, but it is way, way beyond Philips. It makes the machines which make the chips, which ASML on the island of Taiwan uses to create the most incredibly sophisticated microchips. And no other company can manipulate light in a way that these ASML machines can. High-tech chip making is printing with light. It's called photolithography. It's extremely difficult to do. And these machines are worth hundreds of millions of dollars, pounds each. And only ASML can make them. So if we have two things to really worry about, is an earthquake in Japan, which takes out TSMC's factories, or a natural disaster in the Netherlands, which takes out ASML's factory where they make the photolithography machines. I think if they weren't repaired in a short order, you would see a massive impact on the global economy, because we run the global economy on these sophisticated chips.
So a kind of key point in your argument is not that global trade is perfect, because this is a fragility, but it's rather that, look, if you go for autarky, if you go for self-sufficiency, there's a bunch of stuff, unless you're Taiwan, unless you're in the Netherlands, maybe they have a special deal between the two of them, you just can't have.
Yeah.
You can't have any of this tech.
Yeah,
well, so a different way of thinking about trade is actually to strengthen it by actually broadening it.
Yeah, I think, you know, I'm very clear in the book that this isn't some sort of Pangossian diagnosis of the global economy or the global trading system, saying nothing needs to change. I think we've all lived, haven't we, through some big shocks in recent years. The pandemic, which showed you the fragility of certain global supply chains, and then the energy crisis, again, cost of living crisis, which flowed from that. There's clearly problems there. When a big ship gets lodged in the Suez Canal and shuts down container trade from Asia to Europe, you've got a problem. What I argue in the book is that there are other ways to deal with those fragilities than shutting off trade links or doing it yourself. I won't spend a huge amount of time on them, but three I mentioned are mapping those supply chains so you know where those choke points are, you know where those potential fragilities are, because so often now they're so complex that we haven't actually got a good grasp of that, and that's pretty dangerous. So just mapping them is a good step forward for companies and countries. The second one is to stockpile more, you know. If we'd stockpiled in the UK and Europe masks and medical devices and PPE in 2022, we would have been in a lot better position to face the pandemic than we were. So stockpiling is something that should not be downgraded in importance, and something we should be doing a lot more in lots of different areas. And finally, diversification, to your point, Richard. You know, we don't need to be as reliant as we are on certain countries and certain companies. It's not easy to diversify away from a company like ASML or TSMC. You know, the CHIPS Act in America, this big Joe Biden piece of legislation, was a big high-spending attempt to try and produce more of these chips outside of Taiwan and on American soil. And that makes sense, but it's very expensive. The point I would make is that there's lots of areas where it's actually a lot cheaper to do it. So if policymakers and heads of companies go into their daily work thinking about those three key things, I think over time the positive impacts will compound in terms of making the global economy more resilient. So obviously, just to stress, it's a lot easier in some sectors than others. And just to give you, let's circle back to food briefly, away from semiconductors and back to food. What we found out in 2022, after Vladimir Putin invaded Ukraine, I don't know if you all remember, but the global wheat price shot up to about $450 a ton from $300. It was a huge, and that was going to have a disastrous impact because the grain could not get out of Ukraine and Russia through the Black Sea to the Middle East and Africa. It turned out that places like Egypt were more than 90% of their wheat that they needed to make their bread was coming from that part of the world. So they were just really in a lot of trouble as a result of that. The issue is that Ukraine and Russia are not the only countries which produce wheat. They produce a lot of wheat in America. They produce a lot of wheat in Australia. They produce a lot of wheat in France. If the Egyptian authorities and other countries in Africa had taken a decision like, we need to be more diversified in where we are sourcing our wheat from, faced with that unexpected shock, they would have been a lot more resilient and a lot more able to cope. So that's just one example from the global food supply chain. But I think you can read across from that example to lots of different areas where if you're just thinking about diversification, thinking about not putting all your eggs in the same basket as much as you can, you can be more secure, but you can also keep open to the global economy and you can keep reaping those incredible benefits I've been describing from trade.
I think I'm going to ask a couple more questions, everyone, then I'm going to open it up to you. So do start getting your questions ready, and there are people with roaming microphones who are ready to jump up and come to you. Good, great seeing the corners, guys. Okay, so we've got the idea that trade can make everyone better off. We've got the idea that particularly for those in lower income countries, emerging economies, it could be even more important. We've talked about chips and silicon, which is everywhere. Let's talk about something that might seem a bit simpler, a bit more real to people, I hope anyway, which is also everywhere, which I think is potentially currently the kind of best argument sort of against your position, if I was going to argue against it, and that is steel. Mm-hmm. Steel is in everything. Steel is in that bar thing down there. Our copper coins in the UK, those are actually steel. They're just coated with copper. Tin cans are not tin, they're steel. Everything is steel, basically, in the modern economy. Steel, concrete, and chips, I'd say, those three things. Now, the problem there for global trade is oversupply. Mm-hmm. And oversupply is something you do tackle in the book. But if I just put the sort of the case, the anti-globalists' case, it's that China, since the first five-year plan, completely transparently, sometimes I think people characterise China as doing things, you know, in a sort of secretive way, in published plans, mm-hmm. has said that steel is a strategic industry. Because it's a strategic industry, we're going to subsidise it. And because of that, Chinese steel production has absolutely exploded. A good chunk of it, as you rightly say, is actually for home use. Mm-hmm. So it's mm-hmm. used within mainland China. But still, the amount exported has really, really shot up. And it's hard to separate that, I think impossible to separate that, from you know what's going on in Scunthorpe, what's happened in Port Talbot, South Wales. And those kind of events are the sort of things which make people start to think, hold on, this free trade system isn't fair. Mm-hmm. It's hitting certain people, and maybe I'm going to vote against it. So what should we do about overproduction?
Yeah, well, it's a great question. And I listened to your Radio 4 documentary on Port Talbot. It was excellent. I advise you all to do the same. And it really is where the rubber hits the road with this argument, as you rightly outlined there, in terms of the way people have become disaffected with globalisation, who work in key sectors. Now, you talk about Port Talbot and Stunk before. Exactly the same story in the Rust Belt of America. The China shock, I'm sure a lot of you have heard about it, the impact on communities of concentrated employment in certain sectors was really disastrous. And it's clearly fueled a certain level of support for Donald Trump and the backlash against global trade. First thing to say is that this is a problem that China has created in considerable part. I wouldn't try and deny that at all. It's producing far too much steel. That's bad for the world for the reasons you outlined, but it's also actually very bad for China. This isn't a sensible use of the Chinese national resources to have so much steel production, considerably more than it can actually considerably more capacity than it can actually deploy, especially since the property bubble burst a few years ago. So I suppose, look, how do you not throw the baby out with the bathwater is what I would say. I think the issue is, I don't think there's any coherent economic argument, despite what people around Donald Trump say, and perhaps people in this country too, about simply producing more steel for the sake of it, for employment reasons, and also putting up barriers and trying to be autarkic in steel production. Not least because there's trade in steel, there's considerable trade in steel. We import grades of steel which we don't produce, and we export grades of steel, like, you know, we've been reading, haven't we, about how Scunthorpe and Port Talbot export to America.
Yeah.
So trade is important, so that's one reason why you shouldn't just put up barriers. And I suppose the other reason is, it's difficult, I completely agree, but you have to be forward-looking about where steel technology is going. It does look like electric arc furnaces are going to be the opportunity of the future. There's a problem there, as I outline in the book, in terms of the number of workers involved in electric arc furnace producing relative to the old blast furnaces. I would just caution, I don't have any glib answers or simple answers. I think you've got to manage that transition. You've got to manage it with investment to help people who do lose out from global trade to become the losers of global trade to become the winners. That is the fundamental challenge facing democratically elected politicians. Grappling with that is absolutely key. I think the problem is that if you tell people a simple story that closing ourselves off to the rest of the world and just doing it ourselves, ultimately not going to benefit those people who have legitimate grievances against the way they've been treated.
Yeah, I think that's, if I may offer a slight thought of my own on that one, because as you kindly said, I've done some work on that area. I think, could it not link to your mapping point? Mm. You know, in this world we live in, when we can track absolutely everything, is it beyond the wit of man to be able to track where this thing was made? And then to understand if, in some of the countries where this thing was made, there are either human rights violations or massive subsidies or something we don't want. Yeah. And then to adjust that price. To adjust that price in some way through some kind of specified tax or fee that the importer has
to pay. I think that's a fair point. And that is what effectively...
Sorry, microphone. I don't know why I'm looking at you.
That is effectively what the EU is trying to do on ecological grounds or carbon grounds with the carbon border adjustment tax. And there are arguments for doing that in other areas. You know, the US simply bans, don't they, Chinese solar panels on the grounds of Uyghur forced labour. Yeah. I think it's definitely possible. And in terms of carbon, I think there's definitely a strong case for it. I think the issue when it comes to green supply chains is that China is just so dominant when it comes to solar panels, batteries, EVs, that if you start using those tools to adjust the price, you potentially undermine the green transition, which everyone wants to do at the cheapest possible price to get ahead of a possible backlash that it's pushing up the cost of living. So there are trade-offs here, absolutely, but I agree, you know, these are debates which we should be having.
Brilliant. Okay, I'm going to open up to the audience now, so please put your hand up. If I could, if we could start, where can we start? There's three next to each other, so there's a lady at the back and then two people in front of her. We'll take three together, then we'll come to you guys. If you could ask a question and say who you are and where you're from. Thank you.
Hi, thank you for the great lecture. I'm sorry, I didn't quite hear what you just asked me to say, but for my question, I wanted to ask about how you explained very, very well why isolationist policies are unsuccessful and often unrealistic, and I completely agree. But I do find your characterization of globalization quite idealistic at points. A lot of the reason that these isolationist policies gain popularity is not simply because of over-subsidization or the fragility of globalization, but also the impact of it on the working class, which often face outsourcing towards other countries in which labor is cheaper. My question, I suppose, is how would you address these issues and have you addressed them within your book?
Hi, I'm Finn and I'm from the LSE. I'm interested in the countries that have got rich by opening up while also doing lots to promote their national champions. If we look at like China and South Korea, they're extraordinary export-led development stories, but their states also did lots to promote and direct domestic industries. I mean, if we look at South Korea, we see like Now Global Cables, like Samsung, that were very heavily subsidized early on. And of course, in China, you've got a close alignment between the state and private industry. Where do these cases lie, where there's a lot of protectionism, there's some kind of even infant industries like intervention? Where do these cases lie on the kind of globalization and exile divide? Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ben. Yeah, I've really enjoyed this, but also found it slightly annoying, as I'm currently also writing a book that talks to the benefits of global trade and uses vignettes on Ukraine wheat, steel, mapping supply chains, buying local. So now I'm going to have to rethink half of it. But I did appreciate it anyway. And I have a question particularly on, yeah, I suppose, what are the environmental consequences of exile economics? Because you kind of touched upon it at the end, but I'd be interested in pushing you on understanding that.
Okay, three great questions. Are you overly idealistic? What would you do about working class workers? What about national champions, and doesn't it work? And by the way, aren't a lot of European household names companies previously national champions, if you look at the history and then the environment?
Yeah, okay. Yeah, thank you for those questions. Really good. Impacts on working class communities, I think that probably flows out of what we were just talking about with steel, doesn't it? I think there's no point getting around or arguing away. I think economists in the past have fallen into the trap, haven't they, Richard, of sort of suggesting that it's all a distraction, this stuff about the impact on communities. I think in aggregate, the data is pretty clear that overall globalization has increased global productivity. Incomes have gone up in rich and poor countries alike, but there have been concentrated areas of pain, particularly where particular industries have been very focused. And I think there's a strong argument that the issue has not been globalization itself. It's been a failure of redistribution and industrial policy within those particular countries to redistribute those gains. There was enough, the pie grew enough for people to be compensated. It's not easy, but I think the original sin, if you like, was not the global increasing interconnection. It was the failure of politics to deal with the uneven impacts of it. So in the book, I don't sort of shy away from that, and I don't, to be fair, I don't have any comprehensive answers which I outline about how to do that, but I'm very clear that is a challenge that has to be addressed. And that relates to the answer on industrial policy. I think too often protectionism has been conflated with industrial policy, actually. And the assumption has been among certain economists that they're just one and the same thing. Mm. I think if you look at somewhere like South Korea, pretty clear they had a very, very successful industrial policy. But there is a wrinkle about it in the sense that while they were protecting their car industry initially and their steel industry as they were becoming this amazing industrial powerhouse that we all know, they were also encouraging exports. So on the one hand, they were protecting, but on the other hand, they were integrating at the same time. And I think for developing countries, that you can argue that's still quite a justifiable formula, a policy mix. I think for a country like the United States, which is obviously on the technology frontier, I think it's a little bit harder to make that argument, that infant industry argument. And I think it's more likely that if you do what Donald Trump is proposing today, which is simply to impose a huge 50% levy on copper imports, you're actually going to negatively impact US manufacturing rather than help it grow to the next level and enter a new golden age, as he would put it. On the environment, I think I would just really, I've got a whole chapter on green energy and I talked a little bit about it, but I think it is so crucial, that trade-off I mentioned. There is a sense of disaffection with the net zero agenda in this country and many other countries. The US has now gone into full policy hostility towards the renewables transition. The idea that you impose big taxes on imports of solar panels, batteries and EVs, I can't see that doing anything but increasing that sense of disaffection with net zero, because the price of getting to those goals, 2030, 2035, 2050, is just going to be a lot higher if you're not using this incredibly cheap Chinese kit, which they have created. They have got a lead in it, and they've pushed up the productivity and they've pushed along the cost curve through their own industrial policy. I think it's hard. You have to hold two ideas in your head at the same time when it comes to China. One that has wasted huge resources and created a real problem for the rest of the world by overinvesting in things like steel. But it's also potentially created one of the great public goods of the 21st century through its investments in clean technology, especially in developing countries. If they can decarbonize at a price they would just not have been able to do if China hadn't made those investments. So it's difficult. And I understand the security concerns about using Chinese wind turbines or EVs and things. I think there's probably ways around those, but fundamental trade-off. You have to exile economics and the global decarbonisation agenda are fundamentally in tension, I think.
Let's have some more questions. We'll go in the middle here. So, okay, we've got lots and lots of experience. So there's a gentleman in a blue shirt, and then at the front, you had your hand up at the start, and then in the middle there, wearing glasses.
Hi, I'm interrupting this event to tell you about another awesome LSE podcast that we think you'd enjoy. LSE IQ asks social scientists and other experts to answer one intelligent question, like, why do people believe in conspiracy theories? Or, can we afford the super rich? Come check us out. Just search for LSE IQ wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the event.
Hello, I'm Dom. I'm a final year sort of grad in the city sort of thing, moved to London a few years ago. My question is actually about a very simple concept in economics. It's probably actually the one that I got introduced to literally my first A-level lesson many, many years ago now. It's scarcity. So I kind of pose a question to you, Ben, about the fact that there is a claim, and indeed all of the economic theory, discipline, and let's say political theory that I've read as well, like, you know, going back John Stuart Mill, then all the way through to perhaps the more sort of theoretical stuff you learn at A-level uni, has espoused the benefits of trade, and that's, you know, so fair, so on with that. But I just wonder, given we do live effectively in a scarce kind of finite world, what do you make of the claim that effectively everyone can be a winner from trade, and will we inevitably have to deal with the fact that there might be some losers?
Thank you, Dom. There's a guy at the front of the mic.
Yes.
And then could you send it along? I'll come to you next. Thank you.
So I'm a 17-year-old from London. What will the effects of the demographics crisis be on the future of globalisation, noting that there'll be a rise in labour costs in East Asia and Europe? Will that lead potentially to a further outsourcing push?
Great question, thank you. And then along from Tom, and on the middle row here. Or at the back, whoever's got the mic. Yeah. If you've got the mic, you get to ask a question.
Hi, I'm Bernard. I'm just on the LSE mailing list. It seems to me, whilst you refer to Taiwan in passing, the big elephant in the room in relation to globalisation is a possible clash between the United States and China over the future of Taiwan, which must be seen in the context of effect all parts of the world, and the fact that China now controls and owns a large number of United States bonds. Are certainly not... this is a more serious situation before the First World War. Would you care to say something about that scenario?
Great, thank you. So scarcity, demographics, and Taiwan in this crunch of geopolitics.
Yeah, okay. So scarcity, look, as I was saying before, I think there's no question that trade has uneven impacts, even if it grows the overall pie for individual countries and the planet. I wouldn't try and deny that. But I do think it's, you know, going back to, we talked about David Ricardo, weren't they? You know, a country which specialises in its own comparative advantage doesn't have to have an absolute advantage. If it specialises in that, and a country which imports stuff where it's not at the frontier, it's pretty clear that both sides can benefit from trade. I don't think that's in dispute. That's the first stage of your analysis. And then the second stage is, as I said, you know, the furniture factories in North Carolina, which were exposed to Chinese competition in 2002 when China had just entered the World Trade Organization, they were completely wiped out pretty much overnight. I think it's not fitting to say everyone's a winner with trade when you can see that on the ground. What I would say in terms of there are abilities under the existing global rules system of the World Trade Organization to try and prevent that kind of thing happening, and I don't think those were exercised as adequately as they should have been in terms of, you know, temporary adjustments in terms of tariffs to not allow places to be completely devastated in the way they were. I think it comes back to this issue of the baby and the bathwater. Some people completely want to scrap the World Trade Organization and the global rules-based system. That will have very, very serious impacts if everyone goes their own way. So be very, very careful, I think, about you'll miss it when it's gone, I think. And maybe we are already starting to see that. So the demographics question, are we going to see more outsourcing as...
Yes, yeah, so, and just by way of context, what we saw, was it last year or the year before? Suddenly we had a revision to particularly Chinese data, demographic data, and it made very clear that India, which people thought was going to be the biggest economy in terms of population, about 5 or 10 years, is now the biggest and is growing, and China is on the path to decline.
Yeah.
Japan is declining. Korea is really seriously declining. Yeah. So, what does the sort of person power have on trade?
Well, I suppose I'd answer that by saying I don't know, obviously, how this is going to play out. But it is pretty clear that the factories of the future are going to have fewer people in them as we use robotics more to increase productivity. There's not the sort of the old model of globalization where you just outsource it and there's hundreds of people in a factory floor is pretty much over in many ways. I think there's still some gains for some countries from that, but that's going to be increasingly less and less a way of countries growing up the industrial value chain for a start. But then again, people do matter in other ways. It's not just traditional factories. I'm really struck by the data on what are called global capability centres in countries like India and Bangladesh. So these are effectively ways for multinationals to outsource their back office functions to people who are really trained in coding and doing those kind of tasks. Services trade, since 2008, global goods trade as a share of global output has pretty much flatlined, and that's led to this argument about globalization. Global services trade as a share of GDP has continued to rise since the global financial crisis, driven in part by things like digital outsourcing. And what's interesting about that is it's harder to put tariffs on data going across borders than it is to put tariffs on goods going across borders. And that is being driven by the capabilities and education of people in other countries in East Asia. So, you know, I talk about what if globalization fails. I think there is a scenario where globalization succeeds despite everything that's being thrown at it, actually, by politicians, simply because it's just so much more efficient still for multinationals to continue outsourcing digital tasks in that way. So I think that's a really interesting area to watch.
Yeah, and as a LSE prof, it's my duty to give everybody a bit of reading every talk, but actually this is something you can watch. There's a great talk by a guy called Hal Varian. Hal Varian is the chief economist at Google. He also happens to be the person that writes the textbook that students learn from about microeconomics. Some of you will have looked at that. Anyway, his point is, and I don't want to be too sanguine, say that everything's a green light, the future's going to be great, is to remember that. And I've seen this in person. When you go to a country which has gone past the point of demographic decline, so you go to Japan, I saw it in Estonia as well in Europe, the conversation there about something we haven't talked about at all, automation, is completely different. Their conversation is, are the robots going to be able to take the jobs fast enough? Not we're worried they're going to take the jobs. It's like they're not going to take them fast enough. Anyway, Hal Varian has a talk. It's called Bots v. Tots. In the sense, tots, like toddlers, versus robots. We're going to have fewer tots, so that's a loss of labour supply. but we're going to have humanoid robots. So that's an increase in labour supply. And to the extent to which those two can offset each other, and that'll be really hard to manage, don't get me wrong, but to the extent to which those two offset each other, they might be trends we can be slightly less worried about.
Yeah, it was a very good point. And I think it sort of plays into a bit of the... some would call it snake oil from Donald Trump about manufacturing, because a lot of economists think the consequences of the tariffs to reindustrialize America is not going to be more employment in the Rust Belt, but actually more employment of robots in the Rust Belt, as multinationals, if they think these tariffs remain in place, will simply invest in more kit to do what they need to do rather than paying people. The question about
Taiwan,
yeah.
Sort of geopolitics.
Yeah, what I would say about that is, in the book I draw this analogy, I start actually with this analogy in the introduction rather than chapter one, between the 1930s and the present day. There's a lot of echoes in terms of exile economics ideology and policies being pushed. 1930s, after the Smoot-Hawley tariff, there was a general collapse in trade flows. Countries put up barriers against each other, and that was coincided with this geopolitical breakdown in relations as well. The danger is, I think the lesson of history is, as countries start to think about, I'm doing it myself, they start to think about resources, how can I do it myself, how can I get access to the resources I need to do it myself, because I can't rely on trade any longer, that leads to resource nationalism, that leads to military thinking, the militarization of politics in these countries. You saw Nazi Germany, Imperial Japan, there was a considerable element of resource nationalism, and I think that was, it's fair to say, that was stemming from the exile economics arguments of the day. Now, look, I don't want to say we're in the same situation as we were in the 1930s. I think there are disturbing parallels, but I think that is certainly something to consider when you're thinking about economics and geopolitics.
Okay, great. We've got 5 minutes left, so we're going to go into, I knew this would happen, it always does, the LSE, we're going to go into rapid fire Q&A time. So let's, we'll keep doing them in groups of three. So one, two, three down there, and then in the centre here, gentleman in the white shirt, all you three in front of each other. So lady in the black top, gentleman in black top. Yeah, why don't you three go first, and then we'll go here. Yeah, go.
Well, my question is that with this rise of protectionism, do you think it's actually removing the... Well, two things, really. Is it, firstly, do you think it's actually removing the barriers to armed conflict? Because I've actually heard this argument that one of the main reasons why no one wants to start a big war... rise of exile economics might actually make it much more tempting for powerful countries to actually go to war with each other. And my...
Okay. That's great. We've got loads of questions. So yeah. I'll limit everyone to one, if that's okay.
Yeah, actually, I was just let the next person ask something.
Yeah, thank you. If you could pass it behind you. Thank you.
Hi, I'm from the University of Amsterdam. So you just mentioned the Smoot-Hawley Act. I wanted to ask, has America not learned from the past? Is there anything different now that makes Trump think the present tariffs, are a good idea? So is there anything different in the present? Yeah, thank you.
And then pass back, thanks.
Thank you very much. So you mentioned diversity as a way to address some of the vulnerabilities of globalization. But doesn't globalization, which sort of thrives on moving production to where it's most efficient and ultimately sort of reducing capacity of other entities to produce, doesn't that actually reduce the possibility of that as a solution?
Yeah. Should I quickly do that?
I just had a question. Slightly different angle, perhaps, but obviously we're looking at globalization. We're looking at globalization of perhaps services, products, AI technology, internet. Are we not also looking at the export of perhaps structural bias, internet bias, racial inequalities, cultural inequalities that will be manifested elsewhere and propagate perhaps a slightly overbearing capitalist system? So just a slightly different take on. Perhaps they should be thinking very carefully about importing certain sort of things. Perhaps we should be careful about certain sort of AI or internet sort of traps or potentially or cultural traps.
Okay, big question. So trade and war, Exile Icons of War, Smoot Hawley, America Learning Things. Does efficiency and diversity, that's a really interesting question.
Yeah.
Are they intention? Yeah. Intention? And then other risks that, that come with imports.
Yeah.
And you've, sorry, I should say you've got about 20 seconds. All
right, okay, very quickly. Yeah, absolutely. In the First World War, there was this argument from Norman Angell that countries which were so interconnected wouldn't go to war because they all started to lose so much. It proved to be incorrect. Countries went to war. I think that's a salient lesson, that you don't assume that just because you have trade with someone that you can never be in conflict with them. What was the I'll do the is there a tension? Absolutely, I think there is a tension. Efficiency, we've talked about TSMC and ASML. We've seen how globalized supply chains can create those single points of failure, which are potentially extremely damaging. It's perfectly legitimate for countries and companies to say, we're going to buck the market because we can't live with those fragilities. I think that's really, really important, not to be market fundamentalist about it.
Has anything changed in America, was the second question,
yeah,
that sort of justifies the fact that it seems the president hasn't learned from the history?
Well, the short answer is I don't think Trump is a great scholar of history. I mean, he started talking about William McKinley, hasn't he? And he's started to talk about various other points in American history, but I don't think he has, in all honesty, studied history and therefore learnt the lessons of history. Too many echoes, I would say, of mistakes that American politicians and leaders have made before for that to be the case.
Brilliant. Okay. Three more questions and then we'll have to wrap it up. So this gentleman's had his hand up loads, right in the middle. There's a lady at the back with a kind of olive jacket on. Would you call that olive? And then the gentleman in front of her, please.
Hi, I'm Richard from Queen Mary. I'll condense as much as possible. One thing that I think has gone unaddressed so far is the question of power dynamics created by trade between a less economically developed country and a richer country. I think poor countries are greatly incentivized to enter relationships with more rich countries because they can buy their products at higher prices, etc., etc. But they're also then incentivized to become over-reliant on the more powerful country, at which point you end up with a number of consequences, yeah, such as the more powerful country having a say in the less powerful country's politics. The smaller country might be forced to reprioritize their economy around the values of the richer country. And in extreme cases, we've seen countries like the U.S. come in with their military to enact policy changes.
Great question. Thank you. At the back.
Hi, and thank you. So could I ask you to talk about the future of intellectual capital in the context of exile economies?
Yeah.
Since, as we know, most of our leading research essentially involves contributors from all around the world. So I'd be curious to hear about that.
Yeah, great. Hi. Final question of the night.
Yeah, I'm a software engineer from Austria originally, so coming back to your point about tech and China producing a lot of technology like this, historically, I feel like I trade £7 for a sandwich, and then we leave, and then that's it. However, with modern tech, especially given that it's very interconnected, and you have the internet, and you have smart stuff, and cloud stuff, and everything, when I buy infrastructure that is connected to the internet to China, I feel like China could potentially still have influence over me after the trade has happened. So when I, as a country, buy tech from China, I have to keep in mind that they could continue to hold influence, even though maybe trade relations have degraded for war reasons or something like that. So what do you think?
Yeah.
Three fantastic questions to wrap us up. So the first one, power dynamics. Great question. In my own work, I've done reporting from the Congo Democratic Republic, and there you'll see that roads, the whole road system, is being invested in by countries, including China, but other Western countries as well. And they're ending up actually owning the roads, mm-hmm, in another country. Should we be worried about this?
Well, I think we should be worried. I mean, I spoke about Sri Lanka, didn't I? Sri Lanka is in a similar situation where it's a huge debt to China through the Belt and Road process, and that is one of the things that held up Sri Lanka being able to get the bailout package after it went defaulted on its debt, was that they were so in hock to China and China just couldn't get its act together. So, I mean, there are problems there. I can't see problems which are solved by trying to go for autarky in those developing countries. I can't see problems which are solved by tearing down the multinational system that we've built since the Second World War in terms of helping those countries. But I completely agree there is an issue there about those power dynamics. Just take the
on the next one was on, it was on international capital, which is a vital part of your book. So the truth is that the other side of these trade flows are all these capital flows, which are completely international. Are we going to have to do something about this?
Well, there's no time to go into the huge detail on it, but I think I've personally found it quite compelling, the idea that you a better way to force China to rebalance, because China is at the source of this in terms of trade surpluses on a global scale. And China is under-consuming, which leads to that Chinese capital flowing out, and it results in that huge investment in American government debt and various other distortions in the system. I think a better way than countries saying we're going to protect ourselves against China by not letting your goods in is to tax Chinese capital outflows, to put the onus on them, the incentive on them to rebalance their global economy. It's too much detail to get into, but I think that is a legitimate argument, put it that way, albeit with some potentially serious and damaging consequences. But I think increasingly, given China is failing to rebalance its economy, I think it should be increasingly under discussion.
And then the final one was potentially another argument for exile economics, which is, unlike, I think you said with a sandwich or something, you do the trade and it's over. With technology, there might be software or other devices that I don't know in this thing, and I have a kind of ongoing relationship with the place I traded with. Is that another argument you think people are going to use for the exile, for the home
self-sufficiency? They are, it's a brilliant question. Only from the LSE could you get such excellent questions, which go right to the heart of the Achilles heel of my book in some ways. Look, it's backdoors, kill switches in Chinese tech. I don't know enough. I'm not going to pretend to know enough to say glibly that there are problems that can be easily solved. I think they are clearly problems, and they clearly are national security challenges. What I would say is that trade that off, that concern, against the other concerns you have as policymakers on things like decarbonisation, on things like consumer goods, all sorts of areas. Get working on how, I mean, just a couple of things I very briefly discuss in the book is about requiring the localization of data storage rather than it being sent across national borders. It's talking about encouraging Chinese firms to manufacture in Western countries, to kill two birds with one stone. That should potentially make it easier to monitor the kit that's going into them and stress test them. Look, this is comprehensive solutions. I think explore those areas rather than reaching for the we're just not going to import any of it, because that is almost guaranteed to have very negative impacts on your ability as a nation to do lots of other things that you want to do.
Thank you very much, Ben. Let's wrap up with three adverts from me. First advert, please sign up to the Economics Observatory newsletter. You can ask us a question on there. We will answer it, not straight away, and we'll answer it in the form of an essay. Second advert is actually for next Tuesday. We've got Phil Coggan of The Economist, the Financial Times for a long time, a fantastic journalist, an ex colleague of mine and a bit of a mentor of mine, really one of the UK's top financial journalists, talking about his book, The Economic Consequences of Mr. Trump. So that's next Tuesday here at the LSE. Third and most important advert is to say that Ben will be signing copies of his book outside, and that just leaves me to say thanks very much for Ben for coming in and giving us such an inspirational talk.
Thank you, Richard. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. You can subscribe to the LSE Events podcast on your favorite podcast app and help other listeners discover us by leaving a review. Visit lse.ac.uk/events to find out what's on next. We hope you join us at another LSE event soon.